obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I'm Kathy Alcoholic. And my sobriety date is June 4th, 1978. And I want you to know that I am a fallen down, hair on fire drunk. I truly am. I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous 3 weeks before my 19th birthday. And I thought my life was over. I couldn't imagine. First of all, I didn't know that you couldn't drink in AA. I didn't know that. And I might have thought differently about coming to that first meeting had I known that. But anyway, I just knew that I couldn't live like that anymore. You know, I had grown up in this alcoholic family, and I always felt different. We moved in the middle of the night all the time. The police came, you know. Other kids weren't allowed to play with us. You know, that was like normal stuff for us. And so, and the other thing that was that I always thought was different about me and made me different was that my parents divorced when I was like two and my brother was one. And our dad raised us. I guess he kidnapped us, but anyway, I didn't know that for years. And so my mom couldn't find us for years, I guess. But anyway, we lived with our dad. And in those days, you know, men didn't raise their kids. And so I always thought that was what was the matter with me, you know, that if I just lived in the right side of town, or if I just had, you know, regular parents or what, I would be okay. I never, ever, ever, as soon as I could remember, felt okay. I never did. I just always felt different. And you know, I would make up lies about stuff. I would lie where we lived, and you know, because it was just never okay. I would lie about there was this movie star that was on this Daniel Boone show, and I this little kid, and I used to say he was my boyfriend. And I knew that people knew I was lying, but I was not giving that up for anything. But, you know, like, because somehow that would make me okay, right? So anyway, and like I said, I grew up in this alcoholic family, and I just swore I was never going to drink. I didn't like what it did. I didn't like how it, you know, made my dad act. And, you know, he's a very violent drunk, and I didn't like that, and I was never, ever, ever going to do that. And when I was 12, there was a group of us, by this time my mom was back in my life, and there was a group of us that just planned a drink, and planned a drunk, and it was this my 12th summer, and we all had stole beers from our family. We were like collecting them and from our parents and stuff, and so we had this little party in the garage at my house, and I don't know, there were 6, 8, 10 of us. I don't remember how many of those there were. But when I took that drink, I was like, oh my God, where has this been? It never occurred to me that, oh yeah, I'm not going to do that. All I could think of was, I like this and I want more. And I liked immediately how it felt. For the first time ever, I felt like I belonged and that I was okay, you know? And so I wanted to get... I wanted to do it again right away. I was like, let's do this tomorrow, you know. And nobody else did except for one guy, and he immediately became my boyfriend. And so he would steal wine from his church and come to my house and drink it. And that's how we spent the summer. So and I was off and running from that point on. And I never, ever looked back at the fact that I wasn't going to do this. And this might be a problem. Never, ever occurred to me again. And I, from that point on, set out to get some alcohol however I could and whenever I could. And I almost immediately was a blackout drinker. I didn't know it was called blackout. I didn't know that. The first time I didn't know that anybody that other people didn't have blackouts was when I was about 16 or 17, my boyfriend at the time, he said something, and I go, well, I don't remember. We were drinking last night. And he said, what do you mean you don't remember? Like, he just looked at me like I'd grown a second head. Oh, it's my first indication that maybe he didn't drink like me or something. I was like, really? Yeah, I don't remember. I was like, well, I don't remember. And that was normal for me. Anyway, so I went on to marry that guy. And people, our friends were like, oh, this not going to last, it's not going to last. And I was insulted, and they were saying that, you know, it wouldn't last a year. And I want you to know, we lasted 11 months. So that was, I showed them. Woo-hoo. Anyway, this it took me a long time in sobriety to realize this, but I used to describe it that, and it's the truth, we had a knockdown, drag-out relationship. It was very physical, I thought, and not in a good way. It was very violent. And I thought that that was love. That equaled love to me. That's all I knew. I knew nothing different. And, you know, it took me a long time to realize that he was just defending himself, that it was me that was the violent one. but, you know, I blamed him for that for a long time. But, you know, more was revealed, and it really was me. And we ended up not making it, surprising. And right before I got sober, I said to him, I think I might be like my dad. And he said, oh, no, you're not. And I'm like, whew, thank God, because that might mean I had a problem if I was like my dad. And I had all these markers, I thought if I drank in the morning, I would have a problem. Until I start drinking in the morning, then I think that's not a problem. If I drank by myself, then that would mean I had a problem. Until I drank by myself, then that didn't have a problem. The same thing with outside issues. I was like, I'm not ever going to do that, whatever it was, until I did it. And then I'm like, well, that's not a problem. I'll have more of that, you know. So that's how I did everything. And so anyway, I had met this gal that I worked with who did not drink, and I could not imagine not drink. How I didn't like you if you didn't drink. I didn't want to be around you if you didn't drink. I didn't understand you if you didn't drink. And so I didn't want to have anything to do with you if you didn't drink. And because I just couldn't imagine life with that. So I met this gal, and we worked, and she didn't drink, which I thought was the most bizarre thing I'd ever heard of. Anyway, it was her birthday, and I knew that she didn't drink, but I'm a really good friend, so I bought her some Quaaludes, and we were some of you young people might not know what that is. I don't know what the equivalent of that is today, but anyway. So I bought, one for you, two for me, like that. So because I knew she needs something to have a good time. And she had sworn on a stack of Bibles if she ever took a drink again, she would kill herself, which I thought was the most craziest thing. Like, whoa. Anyway, so we went out for her birthday. And, I brought my gift to her and for both of us. And anyway, at this point, since I wasn't legal to drink yet, because I'm not quite 19, I would do most of my drinking at parties. And I had this little problem. I would go to a party with someone, but I never usually came home with who I went with. And since I was married, it was getting to be a little bit of a problem. And I would wake up like, oh, my God, I hope that's my husband next to me, because I wasn't sure anymore. And so that was starting to happen. And so anyway, it was her birthday, and we went out. And, of course, she drank. And I'll never forget waking up that morning. I woke up thinking, I can't do this anymore. Well, my first thought was, I hope that's my husband. And then I was, and then that was okay. I'm like, okay, whew, at least that's out of the way. And then I thought, I can't do this, and I just can't live like this anymore. And I didn't know what to, I just didn't know what to do. And now at almost 55, I want you to know that at 19, 40 sounded old, right? But now it's very young to me, but anyway, I just knew I couldn't live like that, but I didn't know what to do, and I knew that drinking was becoming a problem, and I'm now doing everything I was never ever gonna do. You know, I drove drunk. I blacked out all the time. I missed work all the time. I would get up in the morning and take stuff to help me wake up, and then I would go to work, and then I would come home, and I would take stuff to help me sleep and drink and, you know, and all that stuff. And I couldn't move sometimes on the weekends, and, you know, you all know what it's like. And so anyway, my friend called me and she was crying and she said, I don't want to kill myself. And I said, I don't want to kill myself either. And I don't know what to do. And she said, what do you think about calling Alcoholics Anonymous? And I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous other than it was a place that my dad should go to. And so I said, okay, we'll call. So she came over to my house that that day, which was a Sunday, and she said, and so we called Central Office, and this gal, Cynthia, called us back. And Cynthia said, you know, there's a meeting tomorrow night in, I lived in El Segundo, and there's a meeting in Hawthorne that night, the next night at an Alano Club, and it was a question and answer meeting. And she said, I'll meet you guys there. And so I said, okay. And I thought I was looking good. My hair was all stringy and greasy, and my clothes were dirty, and I wore flip-flops. But I was looking good when I walked into that meeting. And I walked into that meeting, and there are so many older people there, but for me, at 19, they seemed older. And anyway, but they were so loving to me, and everybody said, welcome home. And for the second time in my life, because the first time was when I took that drink, I felt like I was home. And they said, you know what? We know what you're feeling. We know what you have, and we know we have a solution, and we know that you can stay here. And they said, you have a disease. I was so happy to know what was the matter with me. I felt so bad and so wrong my whole life. You know, if I went to one party, I would get to that party, and there was another party, and I think, I should be at the other party. And then I'd go to that other party, and I'm like, I should have stayed at that first party. It just never was okay, right? Nothing was okay. And so they said, you have a disease, and we have a solution, and that we don't drink here one day at a time. And I was so grateful to know that. And, you know, and they said, come back. I don't remember anything about that meeting other than it was a question and answer meeting, and I remember feeling like I was home. And if you're new, I would like to welcome you home, that there, you know, we have a deadly disease, but we have a solution here. You know, they said, I have an allergy of the body coupled by an obsession of the mind, and that you had a program one day at a time, that, and I could not drink one day at a time. And I believed you. I don't know why, but I believed you. And I did every single thing that you told me to do for 2 weeks. And that's about my attention span. Anyway, and then I thought the drinking was that caused me to have affairs. It actually turns out it's me that causes me to have affairs. So I start having an affair right away, and, you know, and then I would be coming home, and people would be drinking and using in my house, and so I knew I could not stay sober like that. So I left that, surprisingly, I left that man, right? And he was not at all broke up about it. He's like, I think that's best. I was in shock, like, really? We've had such a happy home. But anyway, so I moved out, and I moved in with my friend that got sober with me, and we had our own little sober living house, and we had this, another gal moved in with us, and so we had, really, it was like our own sobriety house. And so, you know, my life became going to meetings and working and, you know, and going to meetings, and that's what it was. I got this sponsor that scared the crap out of me. She was like a lady, like wore pearls, went to church. She was a nurse. I mean, completely opposite of me. She scared me to death. And she just said, she would tell me, you know, what to do, today you just get up and you go to work, and then you go to a meeting. And I needed that kind of direction. And she said, you know, you ask God to keep you sober. And I, I would lock myself in the bathroom because I didn't want anybody to see me praying and ask this God that I knew didn't believe in me to keep me sober. And I did that. And, I did what she said, regardless of what I thought. And anyway, I was about, 90 days, 4 months, somewhere sober in that time frame. And I had a great idea. I thought, I looked at sobriety and I looked at drinking and I thought, I don't like the sobriety thing. It's just not for me. And so I decided I was going to drink. There was nobody home. And so I started getting ready to go out. And I was about from here to the end of this table was where my door was. And I was walking out the door and the phone rang. And I had a moment of, I thought, I'm not going to get it, way before answering machines or caller ID or anything. And I picked up the phone, and it was one of my roommate's boyfriend that had 20 years of sobriety. To this day, I've never met him. And he said, "What are you doing? And is Donna home?" Blah, blah. I'm like, "No, she's not home." And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm going to go drink." And that man stayed on the phone with me for 2 hours. And I didn't have to drink. And, everything I had, I was going to drink. And that was my first God shot, and to this day, I don't know. I never met that man, and he saved my life, and I'm so grateful. So after I got off the phone with him, I went to a meeting and I did what I've been told to do here. And I shared about the fact that I wanted to drink and you just loved me and you just said, "It's okay. And you're okay. And we're here and we have this fellowship." And, the other thing that happened to me when I first got sober was that you said, "Keep coming back." And, nobody, everyone usually said, "Get the hell out of here and don't ever come back." So that was very new for me. And then that's when I really started seriously taking my program serious, when I did my fourth step with this nurse, this lady who wore pearls and the complete opposite of me, and we did, I took that fifth step with her, and she said, she started laughing, and she said, "I did that too," and I felt so at home again, that here's this lady who was complete opposite of me, did everything that I did. I felt like that, I did that, and now you don't have to do that anymore. And there, it truly was it was a lifting of me. And it really, as it says in the big book, you start to feel like you belong. And that is what happened to me with working these steps. And, I had that dad I told you I just hated. And I prayed for probably a year to be willing to make an amends to him. I did not like him. I didn't want to make amends to him. And I, by this time I had gotten a new sponsor because I blossomed out to the Manhattan Beach Club, and which was people a little bit more my age, and which was really like 10 years older instead of 20. But and I'd gotten this new sponsor, and she kept telling me just to pray for him and just to pray for the willingness. And so finally I did. I became willing, and I went and I made amends to him. And it just went away. All that hate and anger I'd had for him for so long just went away. And then she told me to try to develop a relationship with him. That, and so I would send him cards and I would call him, and I tried to do those things and develop this relationship with him. And when my dad passed away, it's been about 9 years ago today, I was holding his hand as he took his last breath. And that's where, from I hated that man, I was never going to speak to him again, to what this program did for me. And I had no regrets, and this program truly restores relationships. And so anyway, I went on, made the rest of my amends, and I made amends to that first husband. Then I met, I kept thinking, where's mine? Everybody had a boyfriend and stuff. And my friend said, "Yours is still drinking," which was the truth. He was. And then, but anyway, what it was, God wasn't done with me yet to that point. And so I, because of the steps of this program, I got to the, I it's truly an inside job. And I really got to this place that I knew that if I didn't have a man, if I didn't get married, I didn't have kids or any of that stuff, that I was going to be okay. And I didn't have to drink about it, and I would be okay. It was a complete acceptance and a surrender. And then God put the man in my life, you know. But until that point, I never felt okay without somebody to make me feel better, something to make me feel better. And now, for the first time ever, that hole was full, and it was all a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps. And so anyway, so I did meet Boy Meets Girl on AA campus, and I met my husband, and we've been married in July, it'll be 31 years, so to the same person. Yeah. And I have never had an affair in that whole thing. So I'd like, what I learned in this direction, what I learned was that I was insanely jealous. Like, you know, I was crazy jealous. And one time my husband-to-be we were some AA things, and he was sitting at a table, and a gal came up to him and whispered something in his ear, and I went up and slugged him. He was doing nothing, and because I was crazy with that, you know. And what I learned was, because I was so untrustworthy, I didn't trust anybody. And then one more time I worked the steps on that, you know. And my husband would say to me, I'm not doing anything, it's your problem. And he never ever bought into it, which was the best thing he could have done. So I eventually had to look at myself and find out that it was really me who had the problem. And, you know, and that I'm grateful to say that most of the time I don't have that. And I still have envy for people, or, you know, like if something good happens to somebody, my first thought, it should be me. And then my next thought is, I'm truly happy for you. But it just, you know. But anyway, so I was 5 years sober, and he was 3 years sober, and we got married, and we had these kids, and our oldest child has 4.5 years in this program. And you know, that was one of the most painful things I've ever lived through, was watching my child live this disease, and, you know how powerless I am over it, and then how powerless I am over his disease too. And, you know, but he came to us when he was done, ready, and he said, you know, I can't stop this, and I need to go to AA, because he'd grown up in it. And so he went to a meeting. He's got his own fellowship now. And, you know, I have a greater love for the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous because of my son's sobriety, because the traditions keep Alcoholics Anonymous together. And if it were not for that unity of the traditions, then this program might not have been there for when my son needed it, you know. And now my son has a 3-year-old, and, you know, I don't know if he'll need this program, but thank God that if we adhere to these traditions, this program will stay and be here. And I have a complete, more in-depth love for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous since the day I walked in. And I want to back up for 1 second. When I was a couple years sober, I was like, I'm so bored. And my sponsor said to me, you know, if you get into service, you'll never be bored again. And that's been the truth for me, you know. And I found a love for H&I, and I did that for several years until I had children, and then that kind of became my service. But prior, you know, I think there's something for everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think there's something for all of us here. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to give this program back, you know. And anyway, when I was 2 weeks sober, I went on my very first panel. And the first week I was sober, they made me a greeter. And so being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous has been completely instrumental in my life. And I still, you know, 35 years later, I'm still a service. I still go to meetings. I still have a sponsor. I still sponsor people. And I liked what, I forgot your names, Ed said. I liked what he said too, because I don't want to get caught up in the years. I want to stay in the day, because I believe that I could have another drink in me, but I don't know that I have another sobriety in me. And I don't ever want to take the chance that I could, you know, because I I just known so many people through the years that have picked up a drink, you know. People that I thought have had a much better program than I have ended up drinking, you know. And I don't know why them and not me. Today I just say thank you, God, that it's not me, you know. And I just keep staying here and I keep doing what you tell me to do. And I was trying to figure out how much time I have a time. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up then. This last year has been a really hard year for me, probably the worst year in 35 years. And a year ago, February, my husband had a heart attack followed by quadruple bypass surgery. And the doctor came out and said if he hadn't gotten here when he did, he would not have survived. And that was very scary. And when we went into they transferred from one hospital to the other, and I went to the second hospital, and wouldn't you know, there is one of us there, and it's the only day that she volunteers, and she just hugged me, and we said the serenity prayer together, and I knew it was going to be okay, you know. That was God working in my life, and my husband's doing well today. In July, my brother killed himself as a direct result of this disease, and he ended a 3-day binge by walking off a 12-story building in Long Beach. And for years I tried to get him sober, and then I gave up trying to do that. And then the courts tried to get him sober. His wife and daughter tried to get him sober, but he never thought that he was one of us. He never believed that. He always thought he could do it by himself. And so where he ended up was he hadn't drank in a few years, and then life on life's terms happened, and so he picked up again. And where that led to him after a 3-day binge was to commit suicide. And that, and it breaks my heart. My heart's just broken because of it. But because of you, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous just hugged me up, and you just helped me walk through it and loved me through it. And the only thing I could think of was, how can I be a service to my sister-in-law and my niece? What can I do to help them? That's what you've taught this fallen down, hair on fire drunk, and I am so grateful to be sober. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. As I said, I'm Don Mitchell, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. And I'm about to introduce our second speaker, but before I do, I want to say a few things. I have a little story that I'd like to tell you guys that I've told this story for about 30-some years at every meeting that I go to speak at, and I think Fernando over there has taped it about 35,000 times. I don't know, but 30. The story is about my first sponsor, and my first sponsor was an old man who sobered up in 1941, in March of 1941, by reading the Jack Alexander article in the March edition of the Saturday Evening Post. When this fellowship was fairly new, the book had only been out a couple of years, and he was drinking in Chicago at the time, and he and his wife read this. The front cover was on the front cover of the Saturday Evening Post, and they read the article, and they sat down and they composed a letter to the Saturday Evening Post asking about this new thing called AA and this new thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, asking for more information. And they sent that letter to the Saturday Evening Post, and the Post forwarded the letter to the New York office, and the New York office made sure the old man got sober. And when he used to tell me that there were 800 members of Alcoholics Anonymous when he sobered up, I think in the preface to the second edition of our big book, it says something about 2,000 members at the time, but somewhere in there. And this was my sponsor. He was a great old man. When I met him, he was 83 years old, and I'm about 4 years sober now. And I had just had my first open heart surgery and a triple bypass. I married a sweet young thing that do it to you every time. But and I'm home recovering from this open heart surgery, and Tom had moved down to Laguna Niguel because he wanted to be near the ocean, and he was 87 years old now, and he's 42 years sober. And he called me while I was home recovering, and he said, "Don," he said, "my lung cancer's come back, my emphysema's back, there's nothing they can do for me in the hospital. Could you come down and help me occasionally with my oxygen and whatever I need?" And I said, "Sure, Tom, I'll do anything," because he had always been there for me. And I started doing that, and I'd go down, and we'd talk about his death. He knew he was dying, and he was just going through a door. He had found the same God I found on this program, and he wasn't afraid of dying. He was so grateful for the 42 years of sobriety he had. One night his wife called and said, "Don, could you come down? He needs to talk to you." And so I drove down to Laguna Niguel that night, and I went into his apartment, and they had him in a hospital bed in the front room of this apartment. And his wife brought a chair in, put it next to the hospital bed, and the old man could hardly talk, but he whispered, he said, "Don, tell me about your 12-step call." And funny he should ask that, because I'd had a 12-step call the night before, and it was really a fantastic 12-step call. George called me from central office and gave me this 12-step call, and I started to tell him about it, and I said, and I've got to tell you guys about this 12-step call. It was really grueling. I got this call from central office. We went to Huntington Beach, knocked on this guy's door, and the guy, I could hear him get it off, you know, the couch and falling as he was coming to the door. And when he got to the door, he opened the door, and he was standing there with a T-shirt and nothing else. He was naked from the waist down. And he had burn marks all over his legs where he'd been urinating on himself for days. And I could see behind him and see the beer cans and the crowd. It was one of those kind of 12-step calls. Had you been on it, you were guaranteed of a year of sobriety. You know, it was... So anyway, I start telling the old man about, you know, my 12-step call. I said, "George called me from central office." And about that time, the old man stopped me. And he said, "Don," he said, "I don't like George." And he said, "George is a blowhard. You know, George gets up and talks about guys he sponsors." And he said, "I don't think I like George." And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, "But Tom," I said, "you know, George was working central office. He was donating his time." And the old man thought about it for a minute. I could see the wheels going around. You know, his hand came out from under the covers. He patted my hand and he said, "Don, you're absolutely right. George was doing exactly what George should be doing, and I shouldn't be judging him." And I left him that night, and he died that night. And I realized he gave me the greatest gift anyone could give anyone on this program. He showed me that I could hopefully grow and change right up to the time I died. I'm sure he planned it. He was a sneaky old bastard. But anyway. Now, in the way of an amends, I have to make an amends tonight. And our next speaker, whose name is Glenn, and he's been a dear friend, and he's been giving me 12-step calls for about 34 years, was George. Now, I have said George on a million tapes from here to Sunday every time I've told this story. And from now on, I'm not going to do that. Glenn has given me permission to use his name. So that's an amends, folks. Glenn, come up, my dear friend. Blowhard Glenn.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Thank you, Dr. Bob Jr.
Just keep talking. He screwed up there.
Hello, everybody. My name is Glenn, and I am an alcoholic.
What's your sobriety?
I don't know. In spite of you people thinking I just got kicked out of Charlie Street, take your own darn inventory. Bunch of marshmallows. I have a sobriety date that, by the grace of God, has never been thrown away, started over, given up. And I cherish that to the heart's degree. Because of each and every one of you people that are in this room today. And it blows me away when I find out there are people in this room that are crazy enough to come and listen to me. I have a sobriety date, in spite of what you people think, October the 27th, 1978, one breath at a time. And I'm this close to relapsing. If I think I can do this by myself. Kaka. Kaka. I want to thank our readers that started out today, and I thought, God, if they stutter anymore, I'm never going to get up there. And I heard that one guy say something that everybody related to. I lost my finger. He didn't say what in, but he lost his finger. How many of you people have said that same thing? Anybody found my finger lately? Anybody ever come to, like our fearless speaker there, to came to the next day and you roll over and you say, I came home with you? Anybody ever say those words? I'll never drink again. But officer, I only had one. A whopper. A whopper. Anybody in here know what a blackout is? Any of you chemical gourmets, and you know who you are? This is crazier than a 12-pack and a couple of outside issues. And you rock stars know what I'm talking about, don't you? This is so amazing for me. Because when I got to the doorsteps of AA, October the 26th, Friday night, I drank to go to that meeting. I weighed 165 pounds. I had scabs on my body. I had black and blue marks. I blamed on the cat. Had to blame somebody. I was 43 years old, an engineer by day, and a drunk at night. And I had no idea what was in store for me. When I showed up at that meeting, October the 26th, at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in the city of Tustin, I walked in and it was a little classroom. I thought, Jesus, is this the best you guys got? You're holding your shindigs in little classrooms? I'm 43 years old, I'm an engineer, and now I got to go back to kindergarten? And I walked in the room that night, and they knew that I was dying. They knew that I was empty. They knew that I was dead, but too darn proud to lay down and die. And I looked around the room, and something told me to look at those people very closely. They were sharing their stories. They were sharing their hope. They were sharing their gratitude. They were sharing their unconditional love of one human being that they were sitting next to in one of these Friday night A&A meetings. And I looked at the door, and I looked at them. I made a conscious decision to stop running October the 26th, 1978. And then my God of my own understanding said, "Why don't you ask a stupid question, stupid?" So I did. "Why do you people come to this program of AA? What has sobriety done for you?" And the next thing I knew, they're talking about hope. They're talking about self-respect. They're talking about self-identity. They're talking about having the family back. They're talking about having a job, and they enjoy job. And I looked back at the door, and I had to make that decision. Do I run like a coward that I was at 43 years old? I do. Or do I do the important thing? I raised my hand and I said, "My name is Glenn, and I don't know what the hell I am. I'm German and Irish." That didn't help the situation. You know, too macho. Too macho to be humble. Caca. And when I asked that silly question and they gave me that stupid answer, it gave them hope and it gave them the love and it gave them the feelings and the emotions that they were all starved for. So I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And the next thing I knew, I was 43-year-old bawling baby at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, October the 26th. 1978. When I bawled like a baby, they didn't laugh at me. They didn't say, "Go away and grow up." They gave me this that I was starved for years. They gave me phone numbers, and I said, "I don't have a phone that's connected. I only lived there 3 years. And back then, we didn't have cell phones. But these daggone people kept saying, "Call me. Call me before you drink." "I can't call you because I don't have a phone. Everybody talks, but nobody listens. You know, you've been there. You're part of this mess. Fess up, you sickos." "Huh, Donnie, baby?" And these people gave me these phone numbers, and they said, "You never have to feel this way again. You never have to go through whatever you're going to go through by yourself." And I don't know why, but I believed them. And then there was another meeting right after that meeting at St. Paul's Episcopal Church. I figured, what the hell? There's no booze here. I may as well stay. So I went to the second meeting that Friday night, October the 26th. But I did not feel worthy enough to sit in a chair that was belonging to all you alcoholics that paid the dues to sit in those fancy chairs. So I sat on the floor where I felt I deserved to sit, was on the floor by your shoes. That meeting went on. And I bawled like a baby again. And I couldn't understand it. they gave me this anyway. They told me to stay. They said, keep coming back. They said all kind of crazy words I couldn't understand because it was all a blur. And when the meeting was over with and everybody hugged, it scared the living bejesus out of me. I knew they wanted something in my pocket, which was nothing but an empty wallet. Maybe none of you can relate to that, I don't know. And when the meeting got over with, the young man came up to me and he says, hey, he says, what are you doing tomorrow morning, Saturday morning? I said, I got to get home tonight. I have no clue what I'm going to do tomorrow morning. That's too far away. He says, I've got just the meeting for you tomorrow morning. I said, what time is that meeting? He said, 9:30. And I looked at him and I said, and where is that meeting? Charlie Street, Costa Mesa. He said, go there and you'll see a bunch of rich, famous people like you are. They lied to me. Out and out, looking at me in the face. And he said, go to Charlie Street and you'll find the rich and the famous. And I bought it. I got home that night. I took the last two Budweisers out of my icebox. And I felt like a 10-ton elephant came off my back. And then I got out an Orange County map. And I said, where in the world is Costa Mesa? Down to 55, and then you go over this way. Costa Mesa? Where the hell is that? I only lived in Orange County for 3 years. So Saturday morning, I'm starting out my day. I wound up at Charlie Street. And I saw the names on the wall, and I saw guys just like you guys in the front row and the second row and the back there to get me sober section. You would have got here early like I did, you could be up here in the front. Bunch of candy asses. They don't want to catch alcoholism. Yeah. So I looked at the roster at Charlie Street, and I looked around, and I said, why in the hell would guys come to Charlie Street? And this punk kid comes up to me, and he says, because they got nowhere else to go, old man. That got my head out of my cha-cha. I'm an engineer. I'm German and Irish. And I don't want to wind up at Charlie Street as a resident. So I went home that day. I did not drink. I went to a Saturday night meeting in the city of Tustin at Tustin Hospital. And I am ever so grateful for that meeting, because it was filled with people like you people. Anxious to be sober, participating in their sobriety. And it scared the heck out of me. And then they were talking about commitments. What the hell's a commitment? The next thing I know, I'm going to a meeting back at St. Paul's Episcopal Church. And they wound up sick enough to put me in charge of emptying and cleaning the ashtrays. And I don't smoke. But they said, you are willing to go to any length, right? Ashtrays stink. But so did I used to stink. And my parents both smoked. And we were in bars every night of the week back in St. Louis, Missouri, where I was raised. I did not drink coffee when I got to this crazy program. But it didn't take me long, and I started picking up the coffee cups. I figured if I can't fight them, I got to join them. And you know, one thing led to another. And the next thing I knew, I had a commitment. And it was a door greeter at the... This is before a lot of you young people that are in the room here. It was called the Ebel Club. Oh. There's a few live wires in the audience. Ebel Club out on the peninsula. I'm driving a rusty Roadrunner that I used to sleep in the trunk of because I had class. I used to leave my condo in Tustin and drive down to Irvine after work when I didn't want to go home. And I would find a nice orange grove that was nice and dark and quiet. Take my six-pack of Bud, go to the trunk, open it up, pre-lock it. I'm styling. And then I have to go to work the next day as an engineer. That was not easy. People are looking at me, asking me these stupid questions. How was your weekend? Shit, I don't know. Weekend? What's that? You were talking about blackouts. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Booze. Blackout. It was another world. But anyway, I'm kind of like all over the place. And when Don, Father Time Jr., called about 3 months ago, and he said, Glenn, what are you doing over the Easter weekend? God, I don't even know what I'm doing tomorrow. He said, how would you like to be one of the speakers? And that's when I shut down. How would you like to be one of the speakers at the old timers meeting? Well, I heard him say, Glenn, how would you like to be one of the speakers at the Alzheimer's meeting? Don't laugh, Punky. You too will have this happen to you. See? What goes around comes around. So be kind to your old farts, you know? We might be around here to keep you directing in the right way. But anyway, I was starting to talk about that meeting out at the Ebel Club, out on the peninsula. I'm driving a 1969 Roadrunner. I identify as Glenn. And somehow these people elected me to be a door greeter. I didn't look like this when I got here. This is what sponsorship will do for you. Right? Yeah. You know. Picking up the phone at all weird hours. Glenn, my girlfriend left. What should I do? Well, don't drink. Bang. Glenn, I got a speeding ticket going to work. What should I do? Don't drink. I'm one of these old guys that have a different outlook on sponsorship. You know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a suggestive-only program for you marshmallows. I don't give suggestions. There's the door, candy ass. Go run out. I don't care. Anyway, I have rules. Don't call me if you're drunk. Don't call me if you're loaded. And don't try to call me collect. You like that? Yeah. And now, don't even try to Twitter me. That's been an add-on for me lately. Everywhere I look in meetings, people are twittering and fingering and all this other. It's a new world, you know? The reason I do not accept text messages, it's like taking a message from the wind. It has no emotions. Think about it, you chemical gourmets. How emotional can you get with a text message? It's like trying to push a rope. Oh, they're awake, Don, but I don't know how they're paying attention. We can pull the rope all we want to, but can you visualize pushing a rope? We don't get very far. We just don't get very far. I am so blessed, as the lady was talking about, sponsors, sponsorees, service, being committed. I was 4 months sober when my sponsor suggested, hey, they got an opening at Central Office in Santa Ana. Where's Santa Ana? I did not drink in Santa Ana. I got to get a map to find Central Office. And I drove over there, and there was a beautiful lady behind the desk, and she said, may I help you? I said, I don't know. My boss is pissed. What can you do? But she told me about service, and they had an opening at Central Office to answer phones for people just like you, people that were new and confused and wanted to know where a meeting was. And back then in 1978, we only had 400 meetings a week. Yeah, but we didn't give up. All you young punks came in and kept the program going and going and going. And as the program has changed, it's still the same. I don't drink no matter what, no matter who. Can you, while you're resting, can you give me my stuff? That, yeah, you're getting there. Thank you. Then not a desk, just loose stuff. Not my coat, my loose stuff. And you drop the other one.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm so glad this is a wee program. Thank you. I look around the room today, and you people, that jumped the gun and said you were going to be here when they found out that I, of all people, were going to be here. I literally cried. I look around the room, second row, first row, back row, whatever. How many people back yonder world have heard me speak before? And you're still sober? How many people did I help in your sobriety when you were new? Oh my God. And you're still sober? This should not have happened 35 years ago. Because I walked into the AA program like this. I did not know how to do this. And the language of the heart that these people and everybody in this room that have given to me unconditionally from my very first meeting is such an overpayment. Things that I brought today. Last year at my birthday, this was presented to me with a bunch of guys that had these in the audience, and they were shaking them, telling me to sober up, sober up. That's my ugly picture on the front. But I also brought you my sayings. And I hope this doesn't offend anybody. You know me, don't you? There's a bar around the corner. I don't know where these things came from, other than you people that given to me through my higher power that I cherish and I worship on a daily basis. But when I hear the serenity prayer said, of which I'm going to ask each and every one of you to say the serenity prayer now. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. Now, my version of that. Oh, well. You got it. Could I hear that high pitch again? I didn't touch her, but that's my version of the serenity prayer. Oh, well. You broke a fingernail, you lost your job, you got a jaywalking ticket. Oh, well. Now, for the people that think they're so perfect, they're always out criticizing. Get off the cross, we need the wood. Or, I'm no candy ass. I love her. I love her. Delayed action, Donnie. Delayed action. Here we go. For you macho marshmallows. I love it when you blush. I can talk to the guys on the phone and I can hear them. I say, oh, you're blushing. You're blushing. How can you tell you can't see me? But I can hear you. Here's another little good one. Learn to listen. Listen to learn. God, what a concept. Be in the now by learning to listen. And listening to learn. Chemical Gourmet. Few of you in the room? You used to be a rock star, didn't you? Don't play dumb to me, Punky. I love it when these guys come in and they swear upside down they're only a drug addict. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. What did you start out with? Oh, a little booze. A little bit more booze. You know what a blackout is? Oh, hell yeah. From orange juice? No. Little booze. And there's the blackouts from alcoholism. I don't have a drinking problem. I have a thinking problem, folks. This committee wakes up before I do in the morning. You're going to have a caca day. You ain't going to fit in wherever you go. I love going to meetings where the chip person doesn't know me. Do we have anybody with less than 30 days of sobriety that would like to pick up a newcomer chip and a hug? She just stares me a new asshole. Our perception is distorted, people. For real. I don't know if this guy is in this room. He said he was going to show up today, but a little over 16 years ago, I am at the famous Rock Center in Garden Grove. Sunday morning speaker meeting, slightly above Charlie Street Recovery. Yeah, baby. They have pretty staff over there. They have ladies. They have a lunchroom. They have a patio. They have all kinds of rock stars. And this wonderful young man, I'm standing in the lobby wearing these same pants. I do wash them now and then. And I got a colorful shirt on. And this person comes up to me and he says, hey man, I'm in the Rock Center here for about a week. And let me see if they can maybe find you a bed today. 16 years ago. And then I get up there and I'm the main speaker. See what your perception does? We're screwed. We don't have a drinking issue. We don't have a drug issue. We got a perception of reality that is distorted. The people that grew up, as this lady was talking about today. And your parents did not have time for you. You grew up feeling different. You grew up feeling separated from your classmates. You grew up in fear, abandonment, rejection, abuse. And then we get sober. And all that hate, all that perception wants to come to the surface. And when I'm sponsoring big macho guys, they have a heck of a time. And the ladies go through the same caca too. And it is so sensitive. I have to remain teachable as what was read today. I have to know that all I have is today, right now. And the people that are in this room that I can't decipher who you are all the way in the I thought you were waiting for a bus or something earlier. But you stayed. They got your chairs. Service has been my biggest asset. Answering the phones at central office, talking 12-step calls to people like that. Getting the phone calls at 2 o'clock in the morning saying, I had 20 years of sobriety. And I moved from L.A. to Orange County. And I put my family first. And I put the job first. And I put the car first. And I put the kids first. And I kept thinking I could postpone going over to an AA meeting. Something snapped. And they found a drink. And then they call central office. Why is it always we call recovery after we have committed suicide? It is not a requirement to go in and out. It is not a requirement to get battle scars on our belt because we go in and out 10 times. I have to ask a personal question. How many people in this room, long-time sobriety, newcomer sobriety, have gone to meetings? And then you didn't see somebody that used to go to meetings. And then you hear about them dying. Anybody in the room, raise your hand. Wow. How did it feel? No replies? How? How awful. This is why I do what I do. This is why I talk the way I talk. And if I scare you away, 1-800-SUCKY-SUCKY. You like that one too? There you go. In other words, for you macho marshmallows, you can drop the shovel anytime you choose. Your shovel is your thinker. It will kill you. But this is life. Today, whatever you people do from this day forward is up to you. I have yet to see anybody have sobriety, go back out, and maybe, if they're lucky, they get a chance to talk about how much fun it was. No fun? Caca? Ooey gooey caca. Yeah. I cannot tell you how many people I have witnessed not making it back. This thing stops. I look around the room. I see so many young people. I see so many children of God. So many people that are here before I got here. And if you don't want to stay, sit down and ask yourself why. Why would you want to give up what you have today? Because of a drink? Because of a drug? I hope not. When I got here, there was a man. I have to duplicate maybe what he used to do. His 20 questions. You know. Dr. Paul. Yeah. Acceptance is the answer to all my isms. He used to do these 20 questions at the podium. Do you lose time from work due to thinking? Yes? Okay. Is thinking making your home life unhappy? Do you think with lower companions in an inferior environment? Do you think alone? Oh, God, yes. Soon as I leave the pillow in the morning, I'm thinking. Don't interrupt me. I got a good conversation going. Couple of these that I really love. Have you ever been to a hospital or an institution because of your thinking? When that man would be in a meeting, you people that are new, the room was packed. You had to get there at least an hour early. And when I sat there new and listened to Dr. Paul do his number, I envision an alcoholic's version of Jack Benny. He would wait for the punch to get through to you. And once it happened, we got you. I don't know where I'm going with this. Are you tapping me? Am I over?
No.
Well, don't get friendly unless you mean it.
We got five.
I got five?
Yes.
Here. I'll collect later. Anyway, folks, for the people that got here knowing that I was speaking, you are my family. When I got to the doorsteps of Alcoholics Anonymous, she was talking about dying and he was talking about dying. My father and my mother both died years ago. They were both smokers. I never did smoke. But that Friday night, October the 26th, 1978, 165 pounds. And I got to tell you, Beans, I got five. 8 days into my sobriety, cold turkey. I went to go to work that day as an engineer. My boss is watching me like a hawk. And I went to put my clothes on, and I went to put my shoes on. And I looked down, and my feet all the way up to my knees were swollen from the withdrawal of the constant drinking, 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 drinking. And I didn't know what to do. I knew my boss was watching me. So I looked under my bed, and I had these oversized, fuzzy bedroom slippers. I went to work that day as a proud engineer with my fuzzy bedroom slippers. And then I got to my favorite meeting that night, and the wonderful people in Tustin said, "Welcome to sobriety, Bigfoot." And it was touch and go, because at about 40 days of sobriety, I could be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a cup of coffee in my hand, and you would wear it. I had those little things called seizures. Fun! I'm at work as an engineer. There went my pencil. And then in 90 days of sobriety, cold turkey, no relapses, no pretty foo-foo. I went to get dressed that day, and I couldn't do anything in the bathroom. I pushed, I pulled, I pushed, I pulled. Nothing was working. At 43 years old, German and Irish, and nothing is working, what the hell is sobriety about? I called my sponsor. He said, "Go to the doctor." The doctor said, "Go to the hospital." I went to Tustin Community Hospital, where I knew they had that Saturday night meeting. 91st day of sobriety, I'm in that Saturday night speaker meeting in the city of Tustin with a catheter tube up my front, an IV in my arm, in a wheelchair, and by God, I wanted my 90-day chip. See, I was willing to go to any length. Step one. Step two. Step three. I can't. He can. I darn well better let him. No matter what, I lost that engineering job with 28 years of employment. I've been through prostate cancer. But you know what? I don't give up because of people like you. People like you. People like you. People that are in this room over here. Being of service every Wednesday at Central Office. Being on the 12-step list. Going where I'm needed, going where I'm not wanted. That's part of my job too. I go where I'm not wanted. I'll go to meetings and people know me from the past and they say, "Oh shit, I don't want to talk to you. You pull my covers. 1-800-SUCKY-SUCKY. Again." Oh, I got one more thing. I got to do it. What I've been talking about, what you people gave to me for the last 27 years, 16 years, whatever. The program of unconditional love. I want to love you without clutching. Appreciate you without judging. Join you without invading. Invite you without demanding. Leave you without guilt. Criticize you without blaming. And help you without insulting. And if I can have the same from you, then we can truly meet and enrich each other. My interpretation of that, what goes around comes back tenfold, people. And because you people laughed, giggled, poked fun at me today, but you stayed, you're sick.
I'm not done.
We're almost out of tape. I know, okay, that's his problem.
Because you've all been so wonderful to me. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. We're on time limit. Don't applaud. You interrupt me. Anybody out there like to have a friend? If you do, raise your hand. Look to your left. Look to your right. Shake that hand. Shake that person and call him a winner. Call him a winner. Call him a winner.
There you go.
I know you did. I know.
That was my winner Sunday.
You're a winner. Sit down. No emotional involvements. Thank you all for being teachable. You followed directions wonderfully. I hope I helped just one person. I know you have helped me unbelievable. Thanks for letting me share.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.